What is science? How important is it to our understanding of the world? How do we encourage children to explore a future in imagination, curiosity, and wonder? Dr. Scott Sampson, the president and CEO of Science World, takes us inside the curious minds of scientists. He's worried we're overprogramming and coddling children, and in doing so, driving the inner explorer in them away. He adds, we do so at our own peril. Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you. Dr. Scott Sampson, welcome to Conversations That Matter. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Stu. Nice to be here.
Science plays such an important role in our lives, and yet there's a considerable amount of the population who doesn't understand how it works or even what the nature of science is. How do we describe exactly what science is about?
Well, in some ways, I think it's a failure of science that people don't understand it better. I mean, we as science communicators need to do a better job of explaining it, but I mean, science is everywhere. Science is the study of nature, which includes humans, and we use science every day for everything all around us, whether it's understanding the atmosphere or the iPhones in our pockets or the medical care we receive or the cars we drive or whatever it is. It's all based on science. But not many people think about that. They just sort of go through their lives using the things that are around them, not really realizing that there's a series of basic research which then moves to technology, which then moves to the marketplace.
So, but does science, and this is the interesting thing, is it there to prove new concepts, or is it there to disprove current beliefs?
The process of science is really about testing ideas. And the way we do science is not to find our favorite idea and look for information to support it. The way we do science is to come up with as many hypotheses as we can to explain an idea and then rule them out one by one, and we see what's left over. And if there's just one left over, well, then maybe we have some real evidence to support that idea. And that's how science proceeds over time. And many people don't think about it that way, but that's really what we're doing when we do basic research.
But, okay, so we eliminate all those different hypotheses that we have and we wind up with this one, but does that mean that we stick with it and say forevermore, that's the truth?
No, in many respects, it's funny because there's all this talk these days about facts and alternative facts.
And science proves it.
And science proving things. And it's interesting because scientists are purists in many respects, and you'll often hear there are no such things as facts. And to an extent, that's true, that everything is open in science, and that's one of the things that makes science what it is that we question everything. And yet, there are things like, you know, Newtonian physics didn't just go away when Einstein came up with his ideas. We took Newtonian physics and we inserted that into this new way of looking at the universe that Einstein offered us. So science grows on itself over time. And sometimes there are big ideas that are overthrown, but when it comes to ideas like, for example, evolution, I'm an evolutionary biologist, we know with tremendous confidence that evolution happened on this planet. And the chances that that didn't happen are about the same as the chances that, you know, we don't understand gravity. I mean, we really do know because there's so much evidence that backs up certain ideas. So it's not a matter of just holding on to our pet ideas and saying, this is it forever. We always question it, and there are new paradigms, new ways of thinking that cause big shifts in most areas of science periodically. And that's wonderful. One of the things that we're always trying to convince kids is that we don't know everything yet, that you read that textbook and it sounds like we've figured it all out, but we're just beginning to understand science, really.
So is science helping us write the owner's manual to Earth and space? Because it's not sitting there on a shelf telling us, well, here's how you operate that car or how you rebuild that engine. We had to figure that out. And without science, I don't know that we could have figured it out.
Right. And it's interesting, the metaphor. The notion of spaceship Earth is a powerful metaphor, and it didn't come with an operating manual. And if there is such an operating manual, science provides it. And yet I balk a little bit at that metaphor because we think too much of ourselves as being outside and above nature controlling it. And the reality is we don't know enough to control nature. We don't have the ability to do that. We are dramatically influencing the biosphere all over the planet in dramatic ways, but that doesn't mean we know how to control it and deal with it. Mm-hmm. So that operator's manual may exist at one point. It doesn't exist yet. And we need to have a healthy dose of respect for the natural world so that we can work in collaboration with it to create a thriving future.
Okay, but are we producing the scientists of the future that are going to help us get there? You've written your book, How to Raise a Wild Child, because you're concerned that maybe we might be going off track.
Yeah, I think we have some big challenges these days. I argue that the disconnect between people and nature, and particularly kids and nature, is one of the most pressing and overlooked crises of our time. And that might sound like hyperbole, but think of it this way. If you ask, you know, 100 scientists, what are the most pressing issues today, you'll hear about climate change and species extinctions and habitat destruction and things like that. And I would agree with all those. Mm-hmm. And we are not going to solve those unless we both understand and care about the places that we live. And why is anybody going to care if they don't understand or spend time outside? Mm-hmm. So right today, there's been this indoor migration within a generation. I'm willing to bet that as a kid, you played outside all the time. It was part of what we did in our generation. Right. And nowadays, the average kid spends 7 to 10 hours a day looking at screens and 7 minutes a day playing outdoors. So they are not forming any kind of a bond with the natural world. And that is threatening the health of kids on the one hand and the health of the places that we live on the other.
Mm-hmm. I read that in your book. And went, okay, there's a couple of factors that came into play. As parents in the 70s and 80s in North America, we became paranoid. The danger was lurking around every corner, and we drove our kids inside, and technology helped keep them there. So, you know, how do we break free of that, you know, belief that, well, it's dangerous out there?
Yeah, it's really three factors. There's the fear factor. There's the overscheduling factor. We schedule kids to the nth degree. They don't have time for free play. And there's the tech factor. The fear factor is completely unfounded at some level. The chances of a child being abducted today by a stranger are no greater than they were in 1950 or 1960. Having said that...
Probably less so.
Probably less so. Having said that, the fear is real. And as the father of a teenage girl, I know what that's like, right? Mm-hmm. Second, the overscheduling. We're all worried about our kids being competitive and making sure their resumes are filled out so when they go to college they have a better chance of getting in. And I think that we rob kids, especially young kids, of their childhood by not letting them have that free, unstructured playtime that we had.
And so how does that influence or affect a child's ability to imagine? And what role does imagination play in being a good scientist?
Yeah, it's fundamental. Think about it. I mean, if you are playing a game on your phone or some piece of technology, that's somebody else's imagination that went into that. Mm-hmm. You're not being creative. You're playing the game. When you're outside playing, especially as a kid, you are making up all the rules. And that's the definition of free play. And it turns out that this is critical for building creativity, imagination, critical thinking, scientific thinking, like testing ideas, all of that, socialization, collaboration, all these things happen during play. That play is serious stuff. We're sitting here in the Wonder Gallery and we talk about play equals learning, and it does. Right now there's this notion in our society that play is frivolous, that kids need to be spending their time doing math lessons or some kind of musical instrument classes. Yes, they can do those things, and they need to have that free play. That's what their brains need to grow, and that's what we need in our workforce, is people who can think creatively and adapt to new situations and work well with others. All these things that play can help give us. So right now, people have talked about the extinction of experience, that we're not giving those kids the opportunity to have those real free experiences that allow them to build those critical capacities.
Okay, so here's an interesting thing. Science world is a entity, Schools exist. And so you want to bring them here, you want to create an activity to come here to ignite their imagination. Within schools, you have a curriculum that you have to fill. How do we then create an environment that says, okay, step away from that for a little while, even though we've all invested in this, go play. And so does that not become, you know, we're competing against the very institutions that we've created?
Yeah, it depends on the level, the age of the kid. So in early childhood, really the focus should be play. Up to about 6 years old, that's what kids need, that's what they want, that's what they're built to do. Once you get to that middle childhood phase, it's a little different, and kids are looking to demonstrate competence and show that they can do things. They have the ability to learn and do things that they didn't have before. And we feed that in a place like Science World, and schools can do that too. And then once they get into adolescence, you know, they're really looking to spend time with their friends and take risks. That's what their brains are telling them to do. And we can help that even in places like this, in schools. But it's a matter of, right now, we all exist in isolation from each other. You think about all the educational providers that are out there right now, K through 12 schools, higher education, informal learning, after school programs, summer camps, etc. We all exist in isolation. Mm. What if we all work together to form a learning ecosystem that leverages the assets of all these partners to do things that none of us could ever do on our own or in twos and threes? And that's what we're talking about right now at Science World, and we're talking with partners all over the place, including at SFU and UBC, about how we could collaborate to create this learning ecosystem that would personalize learning so that every student could follow a path that they're passionate about. Mm-hmm. One of the great crises or tragedies of school these days is that students don't see what they're learning in class as relevant to their life outside the school. And BC, to my mind, is actually way ahead of the curve in trying to personalize education, trying to make it hands-on and interactive and place-based. So we're doing great things here. Mm-hmm. We're still figuring it out. There's a brand new curriculum in place and everything. But we are going to be leading the way, I think, in Canada and arguably in North America in this sort of new way of thinking about education. But what I'm talking about is really merging classrooms with communities to do things that right now we can barely imagine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's K through 12. Once we get into the post-secondary environment, you left British Columbia to go do your own study in Ontario and then to the United States. We lose you. So, and now with Santa Ono and Andrew Petter, they seem to appreciate this, but where are we at being able to provide those opportunities to grow in science and then become researchers here within British Columbia?
Yeah, once again, I think I'm heartened by what I see in BC, particularly coming from the U.S. recently, that there is a big interest at the federal level in an innovation agenda. Mm-hmm. There's a big interest at the provincial level in the BC tech strategy. There's this realization that within a generation, 80% of jobs will require literacy in science, technology, engineering, and or math, STEM, and that right now we're not training the folks to have that literacy. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange thing when you think about kids entering kindergarten now. By the time they enter the workforce, most of the jobs that exist today will no longer exist. So we're training students for jobs that don't exist. So what do we need to have then in terms of characters that we're trying to build? Creativity, collaboration, you know, original thinking, critical thinking, and that's what sort of STEM education, and we add the letter A for art and design to make it STEAM, that's what STEAM education really is all about. And I have to say, at the federal level and the provincial level, there's a real emphasis on building this capacity so that BC can help lead the way and we'll have lots of tech-oriented jobs in the future.
So when we take a look at our economy, I read a fascinating article by an economist at MIT who said the most potent instrument for GDP growth is innovation, and it comes from the minds of the people who are within an economy. Is this what is really at stake here for British Columbia as we move forward and as we're embracing high tech and the sciences?
It's interesting. Innovation is one of those words. It's like sustainability. It's become so overused that we don't even really know what it means at some level. having said that, there is a kernel there. You know, there is something that is really important. And it seems to me that BC has the chance to lead the way in Canada in terms of tech. There's this effort now to create links between Seattle and Vancouver, which I think could be really positive, the Cascadia. And so the question is, how do we go about creating an environment here where tech startups feel strong, where we can hire and keep people here? And there's some factors working against us, the cost of living and real estate and things like that. Mm-hmm. But right now, it feels like we are at a moment when BC can take a huge leap forward. And I'm excited to see the investments being made at the provincial level and the federal level.
But what are the most important elements that will allow us to really actually take that leap? We've had opportunities, we've had endowments in the past, and we've let them go by because we go, maybe we can, maybe we can't, and so then we don't. So, you know, are there risks at the moment that we could see this opportunity sail on by?
Absolutely. I think there are risks. And it's a really interesting problem that people debate about. What is the critical mass necessary to allow tech and science to take off mm-hmm. in BC? What do we need to do? And people talk about tech clusters. Do we need to create a cluster more than we have in the past? We talk about investment and venture capital and mm-hmm. how and the role of that. And there's a number of different factors involved, but I think the government money is important because it helps to fund a lot of the basic research as well as some of the tech startups. And that then allows the universities to create these great linkages with business mm-hmm. to spin off these really interesting startups. And some of those then go on. I mean, you look at Stem Cell Technologies, a local company here
right. that's just over there.
Just yeah. next door yeah. that's exploded under the direction of Alan Eaves. And that's an example of what we can do in the future. And if we have more companies like Stem Cell Technologies working together, we will be able to build that cluster.
But an awful lot of that is Alan Eaves, he and his, you know, wife pushing that forward and making it happen. When we take a look at what happened in California going back to the 50s and 60s, and they made this conscious decision to invest in creating what is now the Valley, and you look at what the benefit of that is, but that took foresight and it took risk on behalf of governments. Do we need to be that bold?
Yeah, I think we do need to be bolder than we are. I think we should be thinking about bringing the right people around the table to talk about how to create this, and there have been some discussions to that effect, but I think that we haven't really figured out a strategy to help get us there yet. And this is an interesting moment, and I think you're right. We could lose it. We are on the cutting edge right now, mm-hmm. and we could be on sort of, I'm mixing metaphors, that the leading edge of the wave. But we could fall off. And so I think bringing the right people around the table, figuring out how to move forward, how do we leverage assets federally and provincially and work in collaboration with business, so public-private partnerships, to really take us to that next level, I think that is yet to be really determined, in my bias.
So you talk about the Seattle-Vancouver connection. I'm drawn to a statement by Bill Gates when he said, science can solve the problems of the world. Is he right?
Yes, I think science can solve the problems of the world. And I was, when Bill Gates was in town recently for this Cascadia event, I saw him speak, and there's a couple of things that struck me. One is that Canada has a chance to really step up now that, in particular, you have this situation in the U.S. and other parts of the world, including Europe, where immigration is limited, mm-hmm. and Canada still has an open immigration policy.
Right.
So we can source talent from around the world in ways that many countries can't. So that gives us an advantage. Another thing that I got from these events listening to Gates and others is the biggest problem we have is sourcing talent and building talent. So that's where places like Science World come in, because we are all about catalyzing the conditions to build this talent here at home. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's great to import it from other countries, but we should be investing in this province, in the education system here, and really allowing kids to find out what's out there for them. Many children, particularly from underserved communities, don't even have a clue about the range of options that are available to them. You think about it, the average kid today aspires to be an athlete or a performer, and the chances of them being really successful, and that is like being hit by lightning. The chances of being successful in a STEM career are probably 80%, right? But we got to get it out there.
Well, and is it partly perception? Parents, children look at science and go, oh, it's complicated. I don't know how you're going to get from beginner to leading edge thinker. But it's possible, isn't it?
It is possible. And once again, it's partly a failure of the science education community. We haven't been out there enough. We're doing all we can here, and lots of others are too, but science is fun. Science should be hands-on and interactive and engaging. It shouldn't be about, you know, textbooks and lab strategy. It should really be about engaging with the world, and that's what we're doing now. And I think that, once again, when I compare this to what I've seen south of the border, I feel like we are on that leading edge, and I'm excited. It's one of the reasons I came here.
So out of this conversation, what's the most important thing that you would like somebody to take away from it?
A healthy future is going to require that the citizenry overall is literate and engaged in science. Sustainability will depend on us making good decisions about the world that are based on science. So pushing science education should be just as important as anything we do with math and English, and particularly once you fold in technology and the need for STEM or STEAM literacy, this should be one of the critical initiatives that this province is looking at moving forward.
I applaud the efforts that you're making to have that happen. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you, Stu.
Thanks.
Yeah.